From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now in Exile.
I don't know if he's dead or alive. I want him brought to justice, however.
President Bush, in the first primetime press conference of his presidency, Kofi Annan and the UN are awarded the Nobel Peace Prize as the U.S. and Britain continue to bomb Afghanistan. We'll look at the impact of bombing on the civilian population. And Middle Eastern professor suspended after TV interview connects him to terrorist groups. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now in Exile. This is the War and Peace Report, broadcasting just blocks from the first Ground Zero. I'm Amy Goodman. The first daylight raid on the Afghan capital of Kabul sent shoppers scattering in panic yesterday, jumping on donkey carts and bicycles to flee heavy explosions. A Pakistan-based news agency, the Afghan Islamic Press, reported that U.S. bombers Wednesday night repeatedly attacked the village of Kuram, about several miles west of Jalalabad, completely destroying the village and leaving at least 100 people dead or missing. Meanwhile, the Taliban says that at least 200 people were killed the same day in an airstrike on the remote village of Karam, about 80 miles east of Kabul. U.S. forces have avoided hitting Taliban forces on the plain north of Kabul, fearing that their elimination would allow the Northern Alliance to overrun the capital. Pakistan has threatened to close its airspace to U.S. aircraft and withdraw support for the bombing if that happens. It could also plunge Afghanistan into the kind of chaos already experienced in the 1990s following the collapse of the communist government. A Mujahideen coalition made up of essentially the same groups as the Northern Alliance took Kabul and began fighting among themselves. They left 50,000 people, nearly all civilians, dead and the city in ruins. Meanwhile, Pakistan announced yesterday that it had allowed the U.S. to use two of its air bases, providing the allies with a geographical pincer around Afghanistan that is officially to be used for logistical purposes, but that may serve for much more. This is likely to mean the provision of backup and perhaps base facilities for the next phase of the fighting, which will involve special forces and perhaps other more conventional ground troops. The British newspaper The Independent calls the development a substantial coup for the United States. Protests erupted worldwide against U.S. attacks in Afghanistan today as Muslims mark the first holy day since the bombing began. In Pakistan, demonstrators defied 20,000 police and paramilitary troops and attacked government buildings, fast food restaurants, and vehicles in the port of Karachi. Police fired tear gas on hundreds of people who set fire to a Kentucky Fried Chicken. Meanwhile, thousands have streamed into Quetta in recent days in support of a call for an anti-U.S. jihad. Observers said they expect 50,000 people could protest. In Iran, around 3,000 people, including Afghan refugees, chanted "Down with America" and burned effigies of President Bush and the U.S. flag. They carried signs in English reading "Give peace a chance" and "War is not the answer." Hundreds of police in Indonesia, backed by 37 armored cars, fired water cannon when protesters set fire to an effigy of Bush with a wanted poster hung from his neck. Outside the Capitol, an explosion struck a Kentucky Fried Chicken outlet. In the city of Yogyakarta, protesters this week sealed off a McDonald's and a Pizza Hut. In Malaysia, police fired water cannon at some 2,000 demonstrators protesting outside the U.S. embassy. The demonstrators stood their ground after the first blast of chemically laced water, defying orders to disperse and chanting "Down with America." India is bracing for an expected 35,000 people to protest after prayers today in New Delhi. Meanwhile, in the Gaza Strip, Palestinian riot police prepared for a repeat of Monday's clashes. Israeli radio reported that shipments of riot gear, including helmets and batons, arrived in the Gaza Strip late yesterday from the United States, though Palestinian officials denied knowledge of the shipments. Israeli Prime Minister Ariel Sharon and his son are facing a police investigation into allegations that they violated campaign finance laws in the preparations for this year's elections, which Sharon won in a landslide. Israel's attorney general ordered the criminal inquiry after the state controller reported Sharon may have broken the law by setting up fictitious companies to channel funds from abroad to fund his political activities during the primaries. According to the report released last month, Sharon's son used a company called Annex Research to pay over $1.5 million to people supplying services to Sharon's campaign. In addition to being looked into for corruption right now, General Sharon was found guilty by a commission set up by the Israeli government years ago for responsibility for the killing of thousands of Palestinians at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps in Lebanon. And finally, New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani is rejecting a $10 million donation for victims of the World Trade Center attack from a senior member of the Saudi royal family after he criticized U.S. policy in the Middle East. Giuliani earlier toured the rubble of the Trade Center with Prince Walid, King Fahd's nephew. Walid condemned the attack and offered condolences to the family members of victims, but in a statement he said, "However, at times like these, we must address some of the issues that led to such a criminal attack." He went on to say, "I believe the government of the United States should reexamine its policies in the Middle East and adopt a more balanced stance toward the Palestinian cause." Walid is listed by Forbes magazine as the sixth richest man in the world and has stakes in Citigroup, AOL Time Warner, News Corp, and Saks Fifth Avenue. And Mark Green defeated Fernando Ferrer in the Democratic runoff for mayor of New York yesterday. Happiness is a warm gun, you too, here on Democracy Now in Exile, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, broadcasting just blocks from where the towers of the World Trade Center once stood, and now the fire still burns. President Bush last night gave his first primetime press conference of his presidency. He was questioned, among others, by Helen Thomas.
Urging you to go after Iraq, take out Iraq, Syria, and so forth. Do you really think that the American people will tolerate you widening the war beyond Afghanistan? And I have a follow-up.
Thank you for warning me. Our focus is on Afghanistan and the terrorist network hiding in Afghanistan. Right now. But as well, we're looking for al-Qaeda cells around the world. If we find an al-Qaeda cell operating, and we will urge the host country to bring them to justice, and we're having some progress. We're making progress. We, as I mentioned, Helen, this is a long war against terrorist activity. And the doctrine I spelled out to the American people in front of Congress said not only will we seek out and bring to justice individual terrorists who cause harm to people, to murder people, we will also bring to justice the host governments that sponsor them, that house them, and feed them. You mentioned Iraq. There's no question that the leader of Iraq is an evil man. After all, he gassed his own people. We know he's been developing weapons of mass destruction. And I think it's in his advantage to allow inspectors back in his country to make sure that he's conforming to the agreement he made after he was soundly trounced in the Gulf War. And so we're watching him very carefully. We're watching him carefully. Your follow-up, please.
It's a little offbeat, but...
Okay, well, I expect an offbeat question, frankly.
You've met twice in the White House since you've been in office with Prime Minister Sharon, but you have refused to meet with Yasser Arafat. Mm-hmm. Now that you envision a Palestinian state, will you see and will you meet with Arafat, and if so, when?
I want to assure the American people, in particular our allies who are interested in our position in the Middle East, that we're spending a lot of time dealing with the Middle East. I know there was some concern amongst our allies when the September 11th, right after the September 11th attack, that we would forego any responsibility we have in the Middle East. Secretary of State Powell is doing a great job of staying in contact with both Mr. Arafat and Prime Minister Sharon. I have met with Prime Minister Sharon, and I've assured him every time we met that he has no better friend than the United States of America. I also stated the other day that if we ever get into the Mitchell process where we can start discussing a political solution in the Middle East, that I believe there ought to be a Palestinian state, the boundaries of which will be negotiated by the parties, so long as the Palestinian state recognizes the right of Israel to exist and will treat Israel with respect and will be peaceful on our borders. Obviously, the events of September 11th have prevented overt diplomacy in the Middle East. I prevented it. It's made it, my calendar's a little crowded. On the other hand, I am very much engaged. I have spoken to Prime Minister Sharon again. And if I'm convinced that a meeting with a particular party at this point in time will further the process, I will do so. If it turns out to be a empty photo opportunity that creates expectations that will become dashed, I won't meet. I hope progress is being made. I was pleased to see that Mr. Arafat is trying to control the radical elements within the Palestinian Authority. And I think the world ought to applaud him for that. I hope he's taking measures necessary to reduce the violence in the Middle East so that we can get into the Mitchell process. We're working hard on the topic, Helen. It's a very important part of our foreign policy. David.
Mr. President, good evening. I'd like to ask you for a more complete portrait of your progress so far. Can you tell the American people specifically, what is the state of Osama bin Laden? What is the state of the al-Qaeda network? Are they on the run? To what extent have you been able to disrupt their activities? Do you believe there are members of those cells still in the United States capable of carrying out terrorist acts? And again, do you know whether Osama bin Laden is dead or alive?
Yeah. Let me start backwards. I don't know if he's dead or alive. I want him brought to justice, however.
President Bush at his first primetime news conference. And you are listening to the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman, joined on the telephone by Phyllis Bennis, a longtime Middle East expert with the Institute for Policy Studies. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Phyllis.
Thanks, Amy. Good to be with you.
Before we go to, a contrast, and that is the Nobel Peace Prize Award today, I wanted to get your comment on President Bush's last comments that you just listened to.
Well, it's rather extraordinary, Amy. We're seeing this very explicit quid pro quo being played out as the U.S. struggles to act as if they now support a Palestinian state as a means of keeping their Arab allies and South Asian allies more or less on track in this so-called anti-terrorism coalition. This is not something new. We saw similar behavior from Bush Sr. 11 years ago in the run-up to the Gulf War. But this time around, the conditions, of course, because of the Oslo process and all that has happened since, the conditions are very different. The threat that several reporters, Helen Thomas and other reporters, referred to against Iraq has been escalating in recent days. On Sunday, of course, the United States Ambassador to the United Nations, John Negroponte, brought to the Security Council a letter threatening directly to expand the current U.S. war against Afghanistan to other countries and other organizations. It was widely understood to be referring to Iraq. And then on Monday, there was an exchange of letters in a rather extraordinary fashion between, first, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., who read to his Iraqi counterpart a very bellicose letter, similarly threatening to go after Iraq if Iraq did anything, essentially, that the U.S. wanted to interpret as interfering in the U.S. anti-Afghanistan effort, and saying that if the Iraqis did do anything that the U.S. deemed unacceptable, the U.S. said, we will attack you and we will vanquish you. It was rather extraordinary, in my view, clearly undiplomatic language. The Iraqi ambassador to the U.N. responded similarly, read a letter from his government to the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., stating that Iraq had no intention of involving itself in this in this conflict, and that it had no involvement in terrorist activities either. What makes this all so dangerous is that there has been very explicit acknowledgement by U.S. officials from Vice President Cheney on down, including a number of Israeli officials, indicating very specifically that they do not have any evidence of Iraqi involvement in the events of September 11th, and yet they are using that as an excuse to say that this may be the time to finish the job, as some like to put it. This position, of course, being most forcefully articulated by the Deputy Secretary of Defense, Paul Wolfowitz, so far being held at bay by Secretary of State Colin Powell. But that debate between the Powell pragmatists and the Wolfowitz ideologues has yet to be resolved, and we still don't know whether the possibility of a significant expansion of the war into Iraq, escalating significantly the existing bombing raids that are still continuing in Iraq, is a possibility for the near future.
And the other similarity, of course, with Iraq is that you have, while the U.S. talks about this international coalition, the fact that, once again, it's just Britain and the U.S. going it alone, bombing Afghanistan, and they're not bombing from other air bases on their coalition partner soil, but they're doing it from aircraft carriers and boats in the sea.
Exactly. This speaks very directly to the question of how shaky this so-called coalition actually is. The Bush administration had little choice but to write into the coalition's terms a kind of deniability for every country in the region, every government that wants to embrace the U.S. In order to maintain their access to U.S. Arms, U.S. economic aid, et cetera, but which are faced with massive opposition from their populations. So the U.S. and Britain, as you say, are essentially going it alone, with Canada, Germany, and one or two other countries providing symbolic coalition views, but without any significant military involvement, and, of course, without any authorization from the United Nations. It's the other similarity that we see here from the U.S. history in the Gulf, where after the Gulf War itself, further military actions, the creation of the so-called no-fly zones, the military enforcement of those zones, the bombing of Desert Fox in 1998, all have been carried out in direct violation of U.N. resolutions, the U.N. Charter, and international law. We see the same thing for the war going on in Afghanistan today.
And speaking of the United Nations, Kofi Annan and the UN were just awarded the Nobel Peace Prize. When we come back from our break, I want to get as we go back to when we come back from our break, I want to talk about that with you, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, Kofi Annan. Stay with us.
When the men on the chessboard get up and tell you where to go. Backwards.
You're listening to Democracy Now! In Exile's War and Peace Report with Jefferson Airplane. I am Amy Goodman. The United Nations and its Secretary General Kofi Annan won the Nobel Peace Prize today for, quote, their work for a better organized and more peaceful world. Geir Lindestad, the committee's secretary, noted the winner was picked September 28th, 17 days after the attacks on the World Trade Center and Pentagon, and almost a week into the U.S. military response. And as the Nobel Peace Prize is announced today, the bombs continue to drop in Afghanistan. Phyllis Bennis is our guest again for the next few minutes. She has written the book Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's U.N. Phyllis, tell us who Kofi Annan is again, a very familiar figure to people now, but I don't know if people so much know his background.
Kofi Annan, Amy, is the first Black African Secretary General of the United Nations. He's also the first Secretary General to take that position from within the staff, to be promoted from a low-ranking clerical position as a very young man straight out of school, up through the ranks of the UN to become ultimately the Secretary General. And unlike his predecessor, Boutros-Ghali, he is widely respected throughout the United Nations for his collaborative and cooperative leadership style. He has historically shown extraordinary respect for his colleagues and for the work of the UN staff, who I think have been very excited since he was elected at having one of their own as the Secretary General. He came in the context of the U.S. effort to ensure that Boutros-Ghali would not be reelected. It was at a moment when Madeleine Albright, then the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, was making a strong effort to gain the position she did in fact gain in Clinton's second term as Secretary of State, and chose as part of her campaign to target the United Nations. And in doing so, this is at the same time that she first explicitly used the words that the UN is, quote, a tool of American foreign policy. She took on Boutros-Ghali as her, shall we say, enemy du jour of that period, and went on a campaign to make sure he would not be reelected and that anyone else, as she put it, any other African, it was understood that Africa had its turn again for another, at least one more term, as it turns out now with Kofi Annan being reelected, it will be two more terms. But she understood it would have to be an African, but her position at that time was that anyone other than Boutros-Ghali would be acceptable, and the pressure was strong enough that the UN support for Boutros-Ghali, which had been quite significant, collapsed, and Kofi Annan emerged as the choice widely approved by the United States. As a result of that tie to the U.S., it was assumed that he would be a very pro-U.S., uncritical Secretary General who would be passive in the face of U.S. domination. And in fact, he ended up being, in my view, far more independent than had been anticipated. While he still came into office, and even now, 5 years later, has faced an ongoing problem of U.S. Dismissive attitudes and efforts to undermine the United Nations, and the grave problem to the functioning of the U.N. of the U.S. refusal to pay its dues. Its arrears, U.S. arrears now total somewhere over $2 billion, despite efforts between the two houses of Congress and between Congress and the White House. Those back dues have still not been paid. They are still mounting. And this has presented enormous challenges to the Secretary General. But despite that problem, he has managed to keep the role of the United Nations very central in world affairs. In Iraq, in particular, throughout 1998, he flew to Baghdad on the eve of what appeared at that time to be imminent U.S. bombing, was able to gain a new agreement with the Iraqi leadership after meeting with Saddam Hussein, came back to New York, announced the agreement, got the Security Council on board behind his agreement, and was able to stave off the U.S. bombing for at least that 1 year. He has faced enormous hostility at various points from the U.S. In the context of that visit to Baghdad, a senior member of the Congress, New York Congressman Gerald Solomon, called for Kofi Annan to be horsewhipped. which led, of course, to an extraordinary tough response from the Congressional Black Caucus and others about the extraordinary racism inherent in that kind of a remark of a U.S. congressman calling for the horse whipping in language that harks back to slavery times of a black Secretary General of the United Nations. And he withstood that attack with extraordinary dignity. And Gerald Solomon, in fact, never ran again for his seat. On another occasion, he told members of Congress that your demands, quote, do not intimidate. In fact, they offend, when members of Congress had made demands that Kofi Annan deemed inappropriate. And for all of these reasons, I think it was very appropriate to look at him as deserving of the Nobel Prize. There have been, of course, incidents where one wishes that he would have been more assertive in challenging the United States, most directly perhaps in his creation of what is known as the Global Compact, a corporate entity designed to pull corporations into a partnership with the United Nations. And in the view of many, myself included, it allows corporations with horrific records of human rights violations, labor rights violations, and environmental destruction to blue wash themselves, if you will, by wrapping themselves in the UN flag. This initiative emerged as Annan's answer to the economic crisis caused by the U.S. refusal to pay its dues, but it has come at an enormously high price of providing corporations with significant political cover, particularly the political cover of Kofi Annan's own very strong reputation in particular. There have been other areas of criticism, certainly the failure of the Secretary General to speak out more strongly when the Security Council has taken bad positions. Kofi Annan, during the period when he was the head of peacekeeping at the United Nations, certainly could have been more forthcoming in going public with what he did in fact recognize as the failures of the Security Council in responding to the looming genocide in Rwanda, in failing to provide military support to the safe havens in Srebrenica. But overall, I think that it is a well-deserved award. The statement by the Nobel Committee that said that this could be, quote, interpreted as a contribution to the United Nations as the most powerful and efficient instrument in combating conflicts, I think indicates the possibility of the future hopes of the Nobel Committee that in conflict areas like the U.S. unilateral war against Afghanistan, and particularly on the question of Palestine, an issue which fundamentally belongs right at the center of the United Nations, that there would be a way of returning the UN to a central role in those issues.
Phyllis Bennis, I want to thank you very much for being with us, fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and author of the book Calling the Shots, How Washington Dominates Today's UN. You are listening to the War and Peace Report. In our second hour, for those of you who are running us, we'll be talking about the alternative Nobel, the Right Livelihood Award. This year, it went, among others, to the Trident Plowshares in Britain, and we'll speak with one of the winners, those who engage in nonviolent civil disobedience to try to disarm the nuclear forces of the world. But right now, we're going to continue to talk about weapons. Pre-dawn attacks on Kabul this morning ushered in a sixth day of raids against Afghanistan. U.S. warplanes attacked targets around Kabul and the Taliban's main stronghold of Kandahar. U.S. officials said that B-52 and B-1 bombers had targeted Taliban troops with cluster bombs. Last night, a huge fireball lit up the sky over the eastern part of Kabul in the direction of a training base of bin Laden's al-Qaeda network. Huge detonations could be heard from miles away. The Taliban claimed today that at least 200 people had been killed on Wednesday in an airstrike on the remote village of Karam, about 80 miles east of Kabul. The United States has said repeatedly that its bombing raids are not targeting civilians, but there's been little analysis of what happens to civilian populations subjected to bombing, even under what military officials say are the best of circumstances. The experience of Iraq and Yugoslavia suggests that debates over smart and not-so-smart bombs and the targeting of civilians may be beside the point entirely. William Arkin is with us. He's an independent writer, investigator, and consultant specializing in national security affairs. Welcome to the War and Peace Report, Bill. It's good to have you with us. Can you talk about the weapons being used in Afghanistan right now?
Well, the first thing I guess that needs to be said is we have these newspaper headlines about how Afghanistan is being pounded, and it seems as if every day there is a greater and greater intensity of attacks, wherein the reality is that the attacks have been fairly modest and they haven't been escalating at all. Yesterday, the United States hit 7 targets, the day before 6. The number of bombers and fighter planes that have been dropping bombs day to day has remained fairly steady. And one can do the arithmetic of air warfare in a place the size of the state of Texas to get a sense of really how modest this campaign is. I'm not sure whether or not our distorted view of the level of effort is being created by the media, or if it is wishful thinking on the part of the U.S. military that is being conveyed, or it is a dastardly psychological warfare effort to essentially contribute to the further destabilization of Afghanistan by at least presenting the threat that the use of military force is more successful and more encompassing than it actually is.
There's something interesting going on here. You have the Northern Alliance, which is supported by the United States, battling with the Taliban in the north. And if the U.S. were to bomb the front line there of the Taliban, the Northern Alliance, it sounds like, could immediately overrun them and move right into Kabul and overthrow the government. And yet they're not doing that.
Well, first of all, again, what's most useful, I guess, for your readers, your listeners to understand is how much we tend to compress the outcome just by virtue of instant analysis and instant media. And so whatever it is you describe is not going to happen overnight. The Northern Alliance is spending most of their time, it seems, marching up and down for the TV cameras right now. And the trench lines that they're in north of Kabul have not moved for 5 months, and they certainly have not moved in the 5 days since the war began. I mean, the reality is, if you talk to reporters who are on the ground there, in fact, the Taliban has scattered from the other side of the front lines, either to reinforce positions further north or to get away from the bombs. And so I don't think that the Northern Alliance is going to be the linchpin of the defeat of the Taliban and al-Qaeda network, and nor do I necessarily think that the United States is looking to them to do that. It's really quite, we're in a very funny situation now, because I think that there are people who are supportive of the use of force who want to believe that somehow the force that's being used is undermining the Taliban and defeating al-Qaeda, and that the use of force is going to result in some just outcome. There are those who intuitively oppose the use of force. Your typical Nation reader or your typical Democracy Now! Listener, and yet they're not quite sure what the forensic evidence to use to oppose the use of force. Is it that we're not being accurate enough with our weapons and thereby we're killing civilians, or is it that we're aligning ourselves with the wrong camp in Afghanistan and these are just as much human rights abusers? And my position is that both of those positions are kind of stupid, because basically what's really unfolding here is a very conventional, very uninspired military undertaking, which indicates to me that, in fact, they don't really have a fancy strategy of leveraging the opposition to the Taliban to achieve a victory. The opposition itself is not capable of mounting military operations that we imagine that they will do once they are once the Taliban front lines are decimated, and the actual operation which will unfold, the use of U.S. Special Operations Forces to leapfrog over those static Northern Alliance front lines and attack pockets of al-Qaeda and pockets of Taliban directly, is going to be something that's going to take weeks, if not months, to do, and winter is approaching. This is a very, very conventional, not very inspired, as far as I can tell, not very successful operation after a week.
The GAO, a number of studies have been done since the Persian Gulf War looking at whether the bombs hit their targets. And it turns out afterwards that most of them did not. So when the U.S. says we're not going after civilians, the fact is that civilians are the main, end up being the main target in these situations. What were the effects of the bombing of Iraq?
Well, as senior military advisor to Human Rights Watch, I'm responsible for going to war zones, which I have done in Iraq, Yugoslavia, and Chechnya in the last decade, to look at the effects of bombing. I also have a military background myself, and I teach at the Air War College, so I know something of the subject. It's not that bombs don't work. It's that there's some percentage of anything that doesn't work. On any given day in America, there are a certain number of cars which are otherwise perfectly fine that fail to start. There are a certain number of flat tires. There are a certain number of things that go wrong. Any piece of technology is going to malfunction. When the UN compound was hit in Kabul, it was because a Tomahawk cruise missile, which was targeted against a site nearby, technically malfunctioned and fell to the earth. And that building just coincidentally was in the way. So no one should imagine 100%, and those percentages go up constantly from Vietnam, when probably 50 to 60% of precision-guided weapons were actually hitting their targets, to the Iraq War, where probably somewhere around 70% were hitting their targets, to the Yugoslav War, where we were in the high 70s or low 80s. So the weapons are getting more accurate because the electronics that we use in our Palm Pilots and in our laptops are the same kinds of more reliable electronics that go into weapons, ironically. So the numbers are improving, and given the intensity of bombing campaigns, the number of civilians who are dying is also decreasing. I mean, that is just empirical reality. Some 3,200 or so Iraqi civilians died as a direct result of U.S. bombing in the Gulf War. 500 Yugoslav and Kosovar civilians died as a direct result of NATO bombing in Yugoslavia. There's a lot of reasons why those numbers are so much smaller in Yugoslavia. A lot fewer bombs were dropped. But the physical geography of Yugoslavia was also much different than Iraq. Yugoslavia is a much more densely populated area, and a lot of the military targets were closer into civilian areas. Now you're talking about a more sparsely populated area in Afghanistan, a lower population base, probably even less than 15 million at this point, and an area that is 25 times the size of Kosovo. My expectation is that if in the end we see 100 civilian casualties, given the level of effort over weeks, I would be surprised. Now, having said that, what civilians might die in attacks upon dual-use airports or other types of facilities in which civilians might be present, civilians who, by the way, under the law of war might count as combatants, isn't clear. And the reporting, in fact, has been all across the boards. Taliban representatives in Pakistan have not particularly been putting out big numbers. First day or second day, they said 20 civilians had died. I mean, you know, it's not unbelievable that 20 civilians had died, but if 20 civilians had died, given that we probably dropped no more than 200 bombs in a place the size of the state of Texas, I'd be awfully surprised. So are there going to be mistakes? Absolutely. Are there going to be technical malfunctions? Absolutely. But I wouldn't want people to think that that is the right reason to oppose the use of force or to be uncomfortable with the military action that's unfolding. I'm uncomfortable with the military action that's unfolding, and I generally oppose the use of force because I don't think we know how to use military force to achieve our overall political objectives. And that is coming out in spades right now, and that is a much better argument to make than the weapons aren't going to work.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Bill Arkin, for joining us. Bill Arkin is an independent writer, investigator, and consultant, a Greenpeace USA military expert who also visited Iraq recently with a team from the Harvard International Study Group. When we come back, we'll be speaking with a Middle Eastern professor in Florida who was suspended after a Fox TV interview. Stay with us. You are listening to the War and Peace Report as we break the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman. Since the discovery that two of the people involved in the September 11th attacks on the World Trade Center had attended a Florida pilot training program, the Sunny State seems to have taken on a central position in the eyes of the nation. Sami Alarian is a Middle Eastern professor of computer science at University of South Florida. His Palestinian nationalist views have long been controversial in Tampa, where he lives and works. But after he appeared on the Fox News show, The O'Reilly Factor, where host Bill O'Reilly drew connections between him and terrorist groups, the university was barraged by hundreds of threatening letters and emails. 36 hours after the interview, the University of South Florida put Alarian on paid leave. Alarian is an outspoken support of the Palestinian uprising against the Israeli occupation. In the early 90s, he incorporated the World and Islam Studies Enterprise in Tampa, a research center to bring diverse voices to the Middle East debate. Several years ago, Alarian, who is Kuwaiti, was put on similar paid leave for 2 years while under investigation by the FBI. Who suspected that the Islamic think tank he headed was operating as a front to provide funds for what it called terrorist organizations, as well as help terrorists secure visas. Though Alarian was investigated for 2 years, he was never detained or charged with a crime and has continued to work for the school for the past 3 years until his appearance on Fox last week. The O'Reilly interview focused on Alarian's connections to two former colleagues from the think tank who the FBI alleges are involved in terrorist activities, especially Ramadan Abdullah Shala. 6 months after Shala left the think tank, he resurfaced as the head of the Palestinian Islamic Jihad in the Middle East, which the U.S. State Department has on its list of terrorist organizations. We have a segment of the TV interview that O'Reilly did with Alarian, grilling him about his relationship with Shala.
Taking credit for all kinds of terrorist activity, and you know him pretty well. We've got an explanation here?
Well, I mean, when he came here, he came as a volunteer. He was working in an intellectual think tank, and he taught at the university, and then he left. He said that his father was sick, and he was going back to the occupied territories. And then 6 months later, we were shocked, like everyone else in the world, in which he became the leader of the jihad movement.
You were shocked. You couldn't understand it. He never told you that his political views were that extreme. You were just taken by surprise?
Everyone was. Everyone who knew him here at the University of South Florida, everyone who knew him personally was extremely surprised.
With all due respect, I appreciate you coming on the program. But if I was the CIA, I'd follow you wherever you went.
That was Bill O'Reilly and the O'Reilly factor. Again, after that, the Middle Eastern professor, Al-Aryan, was suspended from the University of South Florida. We're going to go to the professor in just a minute. But first, a comment from Norman Gross, president of Promoting Responsibility in Middle East Reporting, who's mounted an extensive campaign against Al-Aryan and wants him thrown out of the university, presumably this country as well. This is Norman Gross.
Well, I certainly appreciate the opportunity to enlighten America regarding his manipulation of our system. Of course, at this point, I think we ought to realize that he should be dismissed for our security. Let me enlighten you and the listeners of some of his activities, all of which are verifiable. Firstly, he's being afforded much, much too much deferential treatment by the media, which he manipulates adroitly. For example, he refers to my fellow Americans. This impeaches his credibility. He is not my fellow American. Indeed, in 1994, he illegally registered to vote and voted the next month with a false